Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We are seeking to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus. We are seeking to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news of the day. I mean, we're really trying to talk together about what's happening in the world and say to ourselves, all right, from a Christian, redemptive, gospel worldview, how am I going to enter into that conversation that's going on today all around me, and how am I going to enter into that conversation as an ambassador of Jesus Christ? So that's what we're here to do. And what I bring to you today is a headline from Newsweek. And the headline is this: When will I die? Scientists develop new blood test that could reveal life expectancy. So let's just pause there for a moment and take the headline at its, you know, face value. Would you actually trust a doctor to precisely tell you, based on blood work, when you're going to die? And even if they knew, would you want to know? I think that the headline goes far beyond what the article actually then offers. So let me just tell you that in advance, a little spoiler alert, they can't actually tell you when you're going to die. The research to which they are referring was done at Yale, and it's been printed in an archive called BioRxiv, and which is a biological sciences, you know, archive. Anyway, these researchers basically say what we can tell by this blood test is how much older you are than you actually are. So they can't actually tell you when you're going to die, by the way. They can just tell you that, hey, you are biologically 65, but, you know, based on the way you've treated your body, based on the choices that you've made over time, based on that stuff that you did, you know, that now is showing its effects, you're really more like a 70-year-old. Well, that 70-year-old still has a wide range of projected life expectancy in terms of the kinds of tables that we use today to talk about those things. So let me just be really quick to tell you, they cannot tell you when you're going to die. They just can't do that. That's not what they can do. But here's the reason that I thought that this was interesting, and maybe it would be fun for us to talk about. The test measures something called phenotypic age. So it might be kind of fun to know your phenotypic age. You might have taken one of those online things where, compared to your chronological age, you're 5 years younger or you're 5 years older. That's kind of what they're talking about here in this article. It works by measuring 9 what they call biomarkers in the body. And what they're saying is that every year that a person's phenotypic age is above their real age, their chronological or biological age, that their risk of dying rose by 14%. Well, okay, so what does that mean to us? What does it mean that my risk of dying is higher because my phenotypic age is higher than my biological or chronological age? Well, it means that tomorrow might be my last day. Okay, so here's the big news flash. You and I ought to be living as if today might be our last day. Like, every single day, we should be living as Christians all out. We should be living like Paul, to live as Christ, to die as gain. Like, we should be living as if this is the last opportunity we're going to have that conversation that we know we've been needing to have with that non-believing friend or loved one. Today's the day we need to have that conversation, because today may be the last day. Today may not only just be the last day for me or for you. Today may be the last day. Like, I don't know, and you don't know, and these scientists don't know. God knows, right? God has already, he knows the number of our days. This is what Scripture tells us. So there are other kinds of surveys out there attempting to, like, identify, not necessarily how long you're going to live, but what you hope to do before you die. So we have, like, bucket lists and things like that. We also have people who have done the research related to regret. Like, what are the kinds of things that you would regret having not done if your life suddenly came to an end? And so I think that's an interesting conversation for each of us to have. In research done by a palliative care nurse named Brony Ware, the five top things that people who are at the end of life regret having not done, they regret having the courage to live a life that was free from the expectations of others. So they spent their lives trying to live up to other people's expectations instead of, I guess, just living freely as who they were. Okay? They're wishing that they hadn't worked so hard. It's probably that they're wishing they hadn't worked so much. That would be my guess. Wishing they had expressed their feelings and stayed in touch with friends. And wishing that they had simply let themselves be happier. Now, I don't know how many days any of us has left, but I know this. Each one of us is called to live fully and really in every day that God gives us. And so when you think about your family, your sort of genetic dispositions, when you think about the ways in which your parents and grandparents, I mean, I know that if you're like me, you had to fill out all these forms every single time you've got a new physician, right? You have to tell them everything that you know about every person that you're related to and how they have sort of what has caused their death. And I think by that, our doctors are trying to help us live better, live a more healthy life, and predict the kinds of things that we might be prone to developing. And so there are some scary things out there now where you know that if your family has a genetic history or predisposition to some particular strain of cancer or some particular variety of degenerative mental disease, you're sort of living in fear of getting it. And actually, our conversation today is going to be with Stacy Monson. Stacy walked the journey of Alzheimer's in her family more than once and now lives with the, you know, not really the fear, but at some level the anticipation that either she or her husband may, in fact, at some point develop the disease. We live with that in my family. My paternal grandmother, two of my aunts on my dad's side, and a cousin, Barry, who was actually just a couple of years older than me, have all, you know, died as a result of Alzheimer's. And so, you know, Alzheimer's is a reality in the Fowler family tree. On the other side, on the Benefield side of my family tree, you know, we got really people who live a fairly long time with virtually no health concerns, other than we have big hips. I mean, that seems to be our, you know, something we have a proclivity toward. So I think that as we talk about how we're going to live and life expectancy, I just want to key in on those two words, life expectancy. Because for me, life expectancy is not about how many days I can collect here on earth. Life expectancy is what I expect from God in this life and in the life to come. So what's your life expectancy? Because my life expectancy is actually eternal. I've already died. I'm a dead person. I happen to be animated by the Spirit of Christ, having been raised in baptism in him. But I'm a Galatians 2:20 person. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And he's now free to do and free to say whatever he wants with this life and this voice. And so when we think about life expectancy, I as a Christian, I have an eternal life expectancy. And so when the article leads off in Newsweek with life is short, I want to say, well, only one variety of it. Life is eternal. And I think that as Christians, that's our entry point into the conversation. People who are obsessed with the number of days that they are going to get to live here or the limited number of days that some other individual had here, And they think that that is somehow unjust, or they deserve to live longer than that, or that wasn't a full life. That is a totally worldly way of looking at this life of the flesh. And maybe I have this, maybe one of the reasons that I have this perspective is that, you know, death came to visit a lot when I was a teenager. One of my very best friends who I played softball with throughout my youth, she died when she was a senior in high school in a car accident. I was a sophomore. Later that same year, my dad died. A year prior to that, a cousin who was my same age, we were 14, so this would be my freshman year of high school, her name was Angie, and she died of cancer. And about a year before that, I had lost my maternal grandmother. And so I think that because I recognize that death comes, and death does not come predictably when you're 80. It can come when you're 70, it can come when you're 14, it can come when you're 18, it can come when you're 43. Death comes. And so when I think about the reality of life here on earth and then life eternal forevermore, I mean, for me, it's like a vapor thin distance between here and there. And so I just want to encourage you, as we have this conversation with Stacey Monson, to think about your life expectancy. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am joined by Stacey Monson. You can check out Stacey's page at stacymonson.com. You can also follow her on Twitter at Stacey Monson. Stacey's an award-winning author of Open Circle and the Chain of Lakes series, including Shattered Image, Dance of Grace, and The Color of Truth. Her stories reveal an extraordinary God at work in ordinary life, and at every level and every turn of events, Stacey is helping us to see who we are, our real identity, in light of the very nature of who God is. So, Stacey, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. I'm happy to be here.
So, specifically today, we're going to talk about Open Circle. And let me just go ahead and tell folks that this is a very intimate book about Alzheimer's. And so, Stacey, you write about all kinds of challenges that we face in real life when it comes to living out our identity in Christ in the world. But this particular book, Open Circle, you know, it really takes us into a conversation about identity and understanding who we are and not allowing, you know, ourselves to be defined by the world. It's a very intimate look. Can you kind of explore the identity up front of this conversation?
Sure. It's funny. It just seems to come through in all of my books. And I think because it's something we all wrestle with, I certainly do, in light of, you know, just society and the barrage of stuff that comes at us, how we should look. And my husband and I just commented about a commercial about beer. Look great. Look at you. You'll have great friends if you have beer. As we got talking about how does that affect, especially younger people. And so my books have been around that, exploring who we truly are. Who did God make us to be? Not who should we try to be to please society? And that especially came through as my mother struggled with her Alzheimer's and at the same time my mother-in-law. And who were they as they lost their abilities? My mother lost her ability to speak, so she didn't speak the last probably 3 years, but she was still in there, and you could still see it in the spark of humor. She could still laugh. She loved music. She would sit down when the music therapist, the hospice music therapist came. That was the one time she sat down for any length of time, and she would sit and listen to old hymns and things like that. And so it was an interesting take on who are we as we age, too, and who does God still want us to be, and do we even still have a purpose? So that's what was kind of behind this story as I made that journey and as I worked with other seniors who were dealing with dementia.
So let's talk Let's talk about that journey. I mean, you've already referenced so many things just in that opening conversation that, like, I want to till. Like, I want to till the soil of what does the conversation look like in your family when it's time to invite hospice in? What does the conversation look like in your family when you realize that, you know, your mom has reached the stage where she's nonverbal? Like, each one of those points along the journey, you know, I just think that those are questions that most of us would fear to ask a person experiencing this. And yet those are the kinds of conversations we really need to be having with one another.
We really do. And even as a family about ourselves, before that might happen, you know, do I wonder if I'll end up with Alzheimer's or my sister or either my brothers? You know, of course, because we sat so close, up close and personal, so to speak. And so to make these decisions isn't done lightly. It's certainly done with a lot of tears. There are some families, and it breaks my heart, where the families fall apart around this instead of having a conversation about what's best for mom. How do we move forward so that mom has the best quality of life for whatever time is remaining? I was so fortunate in that my mom raised the four of us by herself way back at the day when I didn't know anybody else who had divorced parents. So she raised us. She put herself through college, got a social work degree, a master's degree, you know, was a social worker for years. So I think the four of us were extremely loyal and very protective of her. So when this journey started, we were pretty much on the same page. My brothers were, one's in Iowa, one's in Virginia, and my sister and I are both here in Minneapolis. So the two of us obviously took the lead, and they would say, well, mom sounded okay on the phone. And we'd say, well, yeah, because she perked up because she was talking to you, but you need to see her the other 23 and three quarters hours of her day. And so there were some times where we really had to explain to them what was going on, but they were trusting us and we kept them informed as we went along. So as the time came for hospice, we were really glad, as we're looking back, that we didn't wait. I think the average hospice care is like 2 or 3 days because people don't want to face it. Well, we got her on at about 6 months. It involves working with the medical community. The doctor has to order. It has to be a terminal disease or an issue that you're no longer treating for health, but you're doing more of the palliative care and things. And so she was on hospice probably 6 months. And in that time, we got extra care. She got extra care. She got an extra nurse visit. It made a huge difference. And so each time we, as the four of us, made a decision, then we would report back to them about what was happening. So it was really important to keep that conversation open and to not let fear come in, because we all wanted to just push it away. And you can't do that because life is marching on. The disease is taking its toll. And so I was fortunate in that the four of us really kind of banded together. And that's really the only way you can go forward, because it's such an ugly disease.
Friends, you are listening to the voice of Stacy Monson. She's the author of Open Circle. It's a book about Alzheimer's, and it's intensely personal, because this is a journey that she has walked not only with her mother, but with her mother-in-law as well. Stacy, when I think about emotions, I mean, you just mentioned fear. When I think about emotions, sometimes I think of them as like companions for a part of a journey. And sometimes they're companions that are like fun to have around, and other times they're like companions that we just wish would leave. So I'm wondering about the variety of emotions that you experienced sort of as you began walking this road that would ultimately lead to Alzheimer's and ultimately lead to the loss of your mom. And then how those emotions kind of evolved over time.
As I mentioned, she raised the four of us on her own, and she's very independent from a very early age. And so as things, we started seeing things, she would laugh it off. And one of the things you learn is as people are kind of getting into dementia or Alzheimer's or whatever the issue is, they can cover it really well. And if they stay in their little tiny world of her apartment, for the most part, you'd think, oh, she's doing pretty good. But we'd start seeing things. Like one night she had us for dinner and she said, well, we're having ham. I've never made ham. Yeah, we've had ham, you know, in our lives. We've even eaten Spam a lot, you know. But she just, to her, it was a whole new thing. So to try to say to her, Mom, these are the things we're seeing, it did not, we were never allowed with her to say the A word. Even though she was, I was with her when she was diagnosed, couldn't, because I think she was so terrified. And so her fear was something we tried to take away, even almost carry it ourselves in the privacy of our homes, because she was so afraid we didn't have time, you know, to be afraid. But then we had to have her evaluated with her driving, and they took that away from her. And that is so heart-wrenching for everybody, because that loss of independence for her and for us, because it changed our lives too, it meant we needed to be available, even though we were all working full-time. And so every time there was something new, I can remember being was sort of nose to nose, except she's so much shorter than me, but she was just in my face saying, how can you do this to me? And the tears are running down her face and I'm crying, and we're, you know, Mom, you would feel so awful if you hit a child, you know, while you were driving, or if you got lost, I'd be afraid. And so to try to help her understand, but there was a lot of the fear, a lot of frustration, because she fought us on every step that we made. She wouldn't help us look for housing. She just wouldn't, you know, she just wouldn't acknowledge it. So all the emotions evolved through time, because it's always a new stage. You kind of settle into some kind of plateau, and then off they go into a new, unfamiliar territory. And now you're trying to figure that out. And now she's frustrated and we're frustrated, and we'd be heartbroken because she'd walk with us to the door where she was living. We couldn't have her live with us. We would laugh because she was so naughty. She would get into everything, and she'd eat the cookies that were on the tray. She'd go in the freezer and steal the food. I mean, and she was always laughing, but because of Joyce, they learned to lock the freezer and, you know, all sorts of things. So she had to be watched 24 hours. Well, then we'd go to leave and she'd walk with us to the door, and we'd have to say, you're going to stay here. And then, you know, you'd cry in the elevator as you went up to your car. And so, and that just kept going all the way until she died. And that was probably about an 8-year journey.
Hmm. Friends, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Stacy Monson. You're going to want to visit her website, stacymonson.com, and follow her on Twitter, @StacyMonson. Our conversation is about her most recent book, entitled Open Circle. I'm Carmen LaBerge, this is Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined today by Stacy Monson. We are talking about her most recent book, Open Circle. You might be familiar with her series of books, The Chain of Lakes, Shattered Image, Dance of Grace, Color of Truth. This book, Open Circle, is a really deep dive into Alzheimer's and what that experience is like for a daughter walking with her mom through it. And so, Stacy, welcome again to Connecting Faith.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here talking about this important issue.
So this is a conversation that is being had by, well, or not had, being avoided by families and by churches across the country. Talk with us about the faith impact, the faith part of this for you.
I don't know how people make this journey if you don't have your faith to fall on a lot, because there were a lot of times, it was such a mix of emotions like we were talking about, and sometimes you don't know what to do with those emotions. And and to be able to go back to my faith, to just fall on my knees and say, why are we going through this? And not so much why us, because I've never asked that question. It happens to so many people. But why is this happening? Why can't we find the cause, and why can't we find a cure, and how do I do this? I'm so tired, you know, and I'm so sad. And so without that faith piece, I think it would be very easy just to get lost in the emotions and the work that's involved, because you're working with the staff if they're in a facility. You're working with the state. You're working with all sorts of caregivers and people at all different levels. And to be able to step back and say, okay, I'm not in charge. God is in charge. God's got this. I have to remember that, you know, take a deep breath, ask for God to just guide me through whatever today brings, and then be able to go forward knowing that I maybe don't have the answer, but I know God will provide the solution. So many people, I don't know that there's any of us who doesn't know somebody who's going through it. And what I discovered was the church was not prepared. They had no resources, so I'd go to the people kind of in those positions who I thought would have an answer, didn't have resources at their fingertips. You know, you can't expect them to have the answers, but there's so many resources out there. And so to be able to help parishioners find, okay, here are some websites to check out, here are some local resources, they'll be able to help you, or, you know, I can try to walk this journey with you. I think that's something where the church can really step up to help people that are drowning in the emotions and the financial stress, and sometimes the physical stress. I have a girlfriend right now who's she's 62, caring for her 74-year-old husband who has Alzheimer's. Mm. They need resources because it's a 24/7 job. And right now he's very cheerful and very easy, but I've done support groups, co-led support groups where the husbands were combative, and sometimes it was dangerous for the spouse because the husband wouldn't even recognize that this was his spouse of, you know, 50 years. To be able to go to your church and say, what do I do? Where do I go? I don't even know, you know, and to be given a phone number or a website or something, start here and they will help you. I think that's essential for a healthy congregation, for people to be able to say, this is where I am, this is where I'm struggling, and the church to say, either connect you, you know, I know of people who want to be connected to other caregivers going through this, or here are resources and things. There are a lot of ways I think the church can step up.
So we want to lift up a few of those, and certainly Alzheimer's.net is a place that you can go. Act On, ALZ, which is Act On Alzheimer's, is a place that you can go as well. Each one of those, if you do the / faith communities, there will be some help there. Do you have other websites that you particularly, you know, have found helpful? I mean, I know that like the ERLC has a resource on 11 things you should know about Alzheimer's, but, you know, is there something out there that you generally point to on this particular front?
For us, ALZ.org, which is the Alzheimer's Association, was hugely helpful. And also the sites that you mentioned. They have so much information. They have caregiver tabs where you can call a number 24/7 and just talk to somebody who understands what you're going through and can kind of talk you off the ledge, because it's such a difficult journey. There are financial resources and places to go if you need help, if you need respite care. And for us, at least on ALZ.org and probably a lot of the other sites, there were things that helped us understand the disease. Mm. And so to understand that Alzheimer's literally eats away the brain, and there are holes in the brain. And so to try to force somebody to understand reality is painful for both you and that person, because their reality isn't where you are. And so people are saying, well, don't you remember mom died? Well, to them, that's a new thing. And it's, oh my gosh, my father-in-law would say he, towards the end of his life, just had more just general dementia symptoms. But even with that, we learned to just skirt around the issue of my mother-in-law's death, because he would get just heartbroken each time. And so to understand what is happening physiologically can help caregivers and family members learn better ways to deal with that person, because the goal for all of us is to just have the best possible value of life for, you know, a few months or a few years or however long the journey might be. So all of these resources are great places to start.
So again, friends, that particular website is alz.org, and the 24/7 helpline is 1-800-272-3900. And again, I mean, if you're a person who's thinking to yourself, God sent me this particular program at this minute because I have a family member with Alzheimer's, or I've been diagnosed and I don't know what to do or where to turn. We want to turn you on to alz.org and the helpline, which is 1-800-272-3900. Stacy, I'm one of those people, probably I now think everybody has a family member who's had Alzheimer's, just because I feel like it's everywhere. But for those of us who have a family tree that has lots of Alzheimer's leaves in it, so my paternal grandmother, two of my aunts, and then most recently a cousin who was just 53, succumbed to Alzheimer's. And so I'm not the only person in my family now living with the, you know, sort of diagnostic fear, right? But it's a pretty big family. And so I think that we all look around and we're like, well, it's probably going to be somebody else. Talk with us, you know, talk with us about living in your family, because you've got kids and grandkids. Talk with us about in your family, what those conversations are like in terms of, you know, we don't want to live in fear, but we do want to live in reality.
My mom had a great sense of humor, and my brothers, I'm probably the least funny of the four of us. My brothers are terribly funny. So there can be a lot of kind of dark humor around the topic, which sometimes helps to get the conversation going, because we'll have a good laugh over something, and then it's, you know, somebody will bring it back around to say, okay, but seriously, what if this happens? Or are you paying attention to the research that's out there? Or should we all be getting a baseline exam? Should we be? So we kind of spur each other on to be aware of our own, what's happening with us. I think my mom was probably aware of it. You know, it doesn't just start at one day. It progresses. And so you start, and we all do that as we age. We forget where we put our keys, or we're looking for the phone that we happen to be talking at or something. So you think, oh my gosh, that's it. But it helps when you hear other people are doing that. And yet when there are things that are happening more often, we have to be able to call each other on it and be open to hearing that. And I think fear paralyzes us. And we just think, I'm not going down that road. It can't be me. It's got to be somebody else. And so I think as a family, we've tried to keep that open to talk about. And I have my husband and I, because it was his mother and his uncle on his dad's side and my mother and my grandma on my maternal side, we have it in the tree, and so it's out there, but it doesn't necessarily mean we'll get it. So we can, you know, live in fear that, oh, every single blip in our life means that, or we can say, I need people to call me on behavior if you're starting to see a pattern. You know, you don't have to bug me all the time if I'm just forgetting things, but especially with our daughter and our son, we've said to them, we already apologize if we have to put you through this, but in the meantime, if hopefully we won't, but if you're starting to see behavior, we want you to call us on it and help us to not be defensive and to take the steps needed, because the earlier you're diagnosed, the better the medical community can come around and help you, and the better you are able to deal with it.
And participate in the decisions about what your life is going to look like, because you can still give some input from some advanced directives.
Yep, very true.
Wow, this is deep water. Friends, the book is Open Circle. Tell us briefly about the book, because you and I haven't even talked about it yet, really.
No, it's a fiction, so it is a novel, but it's based on experiences I had with the caregiving community, especially with Open Circle, which is an Augustana, the local Augustana Care. They have three sites, Open Circle sites, which are adult day programs, and adult day, so many people say, well, it's babysitting, but it's not. It's person-centered care to help people have quality of life. And that was a lot of what got me writing this, because of my mom's journey and working with these professionals who every day are in the trenches with people. And aging itself can be difficult, but aging with dementia or with Alzheimer's or whatever can really be difficult. And behavior can be unpredictable, and these people show up every day and work with seniors or the not so seniors, and in your case with a cousin, you know, somebody who's in their 50s, giving them quality of life. And so the story is around an adult day program and what it takes to keep something like that running for the good of the community, for the good of the seniors, and for the good of each individual family that is touched by dementia or Alzheimer's of some sort.
Stacey, we so appreciate your openness and your vulnerability and your book. Again, friends, her website is StaceyMonson.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Stacey Monson. You can also get the book. It's entitled Open Circle. Stacey Monson, thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Thanks for having me, Carmen.
Thank you. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
All right, friends, this is Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. So I don't know about you, but that conversation with Stacey left me, you know, sober and thinking not only about my own family, but about myself, thinking about thinking and what a privilege it is to be in command of your thoughts. It leaves me considering, you know, how is it that I'm actually giving every thought over captive to Christ? And, you know, how am I ministering to those individuals who I know are caring today for people with Alzheimer's or people with other mental degenerative diseases? And so it also gets me thinking about just the burdens that people are bearing out there across the culture and in the world that they're too great to bear. Like, there's no way that you could walk that journey without faith, or at least I can't imagine how that journey could be walked without faith, because it's a burden too great to bear. And so in today's connecting point, I want to share with you this particular story. Her name is Nicole Engler, and I just really want to compel each and every listener to pray by name for Nicole Engler today. Nicole is 38 years old. She was taken into police custody on June the 21st after her 20-month-old daughter, Remy, was found dead in her car in Roseburg, Oregon. So here's what happened. Nicole got up one morning and her husband was asleep on the couch. Her husband is normally the person who takes Remy to daycare, but he was asleep and she thought, oh, I'll just take Remy to daycare on my way to work. By the way, she's a pediatric nurse. And so she, you know, she got Remy dressed, she got dressed, she puts Remy in the back seat of the car, and then she, like the rest of us, had the tendency to just go into automatic, you know, all the automatic things that we do according to our routine. And her routine did not include dropping Remy off at daycare. And she never dropped her off. And so hours later, she returned to her car to find 20-month-old Remy unconscious and blue, not surprisingly. She was so distraught that witnesses say that her screams could be heard across the hospital parking lot. So there's no question that this is an individual who had no malicious intent. This is, according to, I mean, even law enforcement, quote, this is not about a heartless mother who does the unthinkable. And so this woman, Nicole Engler, now charged with second-degree manslaughter behind bars, and while behind bars, begging the guards to let her kill herself because she is enduring a grief too great to bear. Why bring this up? I bring this up because when we talk about life expectancy, and when we talk about what to expect in life, and when we talk about what we expect of ourselves and what we expect of one another, and when we talk about what we expect our marriages to be like or what we expect our families to be like, or, you know, we're talking here about a family of, you know, that seemingly had it all right up until the point that the horrible happened. And so this is a call to prayer, because I don't think Nicole Engler is alone in this kind of grief. She's certainly not the only person who has made the kind of mistake that has resulted in not only the death of another person, but the death of a dream. I mean, the death of what a family is going to look like and experience. And so I read recently about three very young people who I guess are like YouTube sensations, and they go and they do these off the grid, wild and crazy things. And it's all supposed to be about, you know, living life to the fullest and demonstrating that, you know, life on the edge is better than life anywhere else. And these are people in the prime of their life. We're talking about people in their very early 20s, and they have more than 1 million followers on YouTube and Instagram. And I'm not going to give you the site because I don't really want to drive interest in it. But I want you to pray for their families, because three of them doing something that, you know, frankly, was just beyond the bounds of, you know, the signage which says don't go there and don't do that. They were playing around at the top of a 100-foot waterfall, and the first one slipped and the other two tried to save the third, and all three of them went over to their deaths. And again, why tell you these kinds of stories? Because life is not always predictable in terms of its length. And you and I, as Christians, absolutely, we value every life as precious. And we value life itself as meaningful. And we value every day and even every moment of every day. And I think that we have to live expecting always the unexpected and anticipating miracles when we talk about our life expectancy as Christians. And we also need to help other people see that this is not all that there is. There is life beyond this life. Now, there's a huge question about where you're going to spend the life beyond this life, but there's life beyond this life. In fact, this life is but a breath or a blink compared to the life that we will live eternally. And, you know, I think that we all have to decide, like, am I going to be defined by my past? Am I going to be defined by a grief that's too great for me to bear? Am I going to be defined by something tragic that happened to somebody that I love, or something that someone some sin that someone perpetrated against me? Or am I going to allow my life to be defined by a God who is not only eternal, but redemptive and gracious and loves me and wants to be in an eternal relationship with me as his beloved child? I have a person in my life who allows her life to be completely defined by the loss of her adolescent child. It happened more than a decade ago now. He was tragically killed. His life actually now lives in certain ways in other people because they made the gracious decision to donate his organs that other people might have eyes that see and a heart that beats and a liver and lungs. And I mean, that's miraculous that all of that can happen today. But this individual, this mother, she's now lived more than a decade of her life completely defined by the death of her child. No joy, no sense of redemption, no sense of God's grace, no sense of an eternity that's worthy of her son. And it has affected her relationship with her other children, her relationship with her husband, and every other relationship in her life. And I guess that I want to encourage us today to not allow ourselves to be defined by the imminent threat of a disease to which we might be predisposed, not to allow ourselves to be defined by even something as horrible and tragic and grievous as the untimely death of a child. Because this is the life that God has given us to live. This is the life, this is the day that the Lord has made. And in it, we are supposed to, what? Well, actually rejoice and be glad. In everything? Yes, actually, in all circumstances. Living in the mystery of the knowledge of who Christ is and what he has done. And because of that, the life that we expect to live forever. And so I charge each of us today to, first of all, reach out to people who are trying to bear a burden of grief that is absolutely too great to bear. It could be the kind of guilt that Nicole Engler is suffering. It could be the emptiness that is experienced by a parent who loses a child. And it could be the kind of experience that Stacey Monson shared with us about, you know, a child who loses a parent, but over a very long course of time through an increasingly disappearing, an everyday more and more disappearing parent because of Alzheimer's or dementia. And so, you know, today might be the day not only to pray, but when God brings those people to mind, I'm really going to encourage you to reach out. Give them a call. Send them an email. Let them know that you are thinking about them. And then don't say, what can I do for you? Actually, just think of something to do for them and do it. And 90% of ministry is just showing up. I mean, you know, I maybe more than 90%. I don't know. You know, Jesus had to actually show up in the incarnation before he could then do for us all the things that we needed for him to do. But the first part of it was showing up. And so today, my encouragement through prayer or some other avenue is going to be that each one of us would simply, you know, show up and help people bear the grief that's too great to bear. All right, friends, that's my little conversation about life expectancy today. Thank you for joining me on Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Have a great day, and God bless. This is Carmen LaBerge. Thanks for listening to the podcast from Connecting Faith.